The most exciting part of a vacation stay at a home rental? Easy. It's being greeted upon arrival with a rusted lockbox affixed to the underside of a stranger's condo. Yeah, you simply twist knobs, click gears, jiggle it, and then rip it off its moorings, and voila! Your prize is a key to a questionable home rental and maybe tetanus. When you just want to get your vacation started by actually getting into your room, it matters where you stay. At Hilton, we deliver your key right to your phone on the Hilton Honors app. Hilton, for the stay.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Shakespeare wrote, "The past is prologue." William Faulkner, a son of the South, wrote, "The past is never dead. It isn't even past." In recent days, we heard reverberations of America's original sin, with dispiriting reminders of America's racist past. A photograph of a man dressed in blackface standing next to someone clad in the white cloak of the KKK. That photo raised tough questions for Virginia Governor Ralph Northam. It appeared on his medical school yearbook page from 1984. Once it surfaced, the governor said he was in the photo. Then later, he changed his account.
"While I did not appear in this photo, I am not surprised by its appearance in the EVMS yearbook. In the place and time where I grew up, many actions that we rightfully recognize as abhorrent today were commonplace."
In recent years and months, we've seen debates over how much the past is past, arguments over rhetoric and rights, how we treat one another as citizens and as people, enduring arguments that resound through the centuries. Take 1896, a year that marks one of the country's most notable and infamous Supreme Court rulings, Plessy versus Ferguson. Its ruling allowed a state law requiring racial segregation in train cars, a doctrine that came to be known as separate but equal. People may assume such discrimination was the inevitable way station after slavery, en route to a better future that would play out decades later. But that ruling did not have to be inevitable. It involved key figures deciding to not just allow but codify racial oppression throughout the country, and its vestiges remain with us to this day. This hour on Point, looking at racial history in America through the prism of this crucial case. Join us. What are your thoughts on the recent events connecting both the governor of Virginia and the attorney general to wearing blackface decades ago? Have we overestimated the progress of race relations in America since the civil rights era? How do you interpret the current conversation on race coursing through the nation? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us from Baltimore is Steve Luxenberg. He's a longtime senior editor at the Washington Post, and an author. His new book is Separate: The Story of Plessy v. Ferguson and America's Journey from Slavery to Segregation. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Steve, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David. Glad to be here.
It's been kind of amazing in recent weeks. I feel as though, you know, you've been delving deep into the historic archives, and it right now it feels like very contemporary news, doesn't it?
Well, you know, race is a part of our national conversation. It has been since the beginning, as you noted, when slavery was embedded into the Constitution, and it continues to this day. And that's what partly what motivated me to write this book, is I wanted to go back and understand the roots of this conversation, a conversation I think that we have every day and sometimes avoid having every day.
Yeah, we moved up this show by a week because we wanted to take advantage of your thinking about this and as a historian and as a journalist to kind of fuse them together. Over the course of this hour, we will be bringing in Janae Nelson, a senior figure at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, to talk about how some of these things are being played out, thought through, and fought out today. But right now, I do, Steve Luxenberg, want to go to your book, Separate: The Story of Plessy versus Ferguson, and talk a little bit about this. The case has been written about. One of the things that you say in the book is you wanted to figure out how we got there. What intrigued you about that journey?
Well, you know, Plessy is the case that we all equate with separate but equal. But those three words actually don't appear in the majority decision. It was a 7-1 ruling mm-hmm. by the court at that time. I wanted to understand how we had gotten from the Civil War to Plessy. Whether it was – people always say, well, Of course that was the result of this ruling. Everybody was racist in the 19th century. Wrong. Everybody was not racist. People also say, well, civil rights, that started in the 60s, didn't it? Meaning the 1960s. Wrong. Civil rights movements began in the 1860s. There were three civil rights acts, three, between 1865 and 1875. So there was a huge change that was going on. And when people talk about the Constitution, I always wonder what Constitution they're talking about, the one that had slavery embedded in it or the one that was a revolutionary change in the years after the Civil War where there were three civil rights amendments that rejected slavery. So you can't talk about a single Constitution.
One of the things that's fascinating about this book, as a, something of a student of history, was the way in which it echoed. I mean, we think about Rosa Parks. We think about people consciously testing laws in the maybe the 40s, but particularly the 50s and 60s to show the public and the legal system the injustice of it all. But that all played out a century earlier, as you write about, or almost a century earlier. We've got a little excerpt. I think it's from page 261 for you to read for us. But here you're writing about one of the earliest examples of, in a sense, resistance. The setting is New Orleans, an otherwise gorgeous day in 1867, and the day that an African-American resistor named William Nichols would defy the law and take a stand for himself to sit where he was forbidden to do so.
That's
right.
Why
don't you go ahead and read that for us?
I'd love to. It starts here. The mule-drawn streetcar, number 132, bore no star. That meant only whites could board. As the coach trundled up Canal Street, passengers were queuing up, reveling in a dazzling New Orleans afternoon. It was Sunday, April 28th, 1867. The swarms in the street and tropical temperatures prompted the Daily Picayune to gush the following day. Gay parties were going in every direction. There was no population anywhere that goes out of doors to enjoy the lovely weather more than the people of New Orleans. In short, a perfect afternoon for taking a stand and getting arrested. The driver reined the hulking streetcar to a stop, wheels shuddering on the iron track. William Nichols stood ready, fair in hand, intent on occupying a seat among the contemptuous white passengers, intent on defying the driver's order to leave, intent on telling the driver, I have as good a right to be here as any white man, intent on saying, no, sir, I'm not waiting for a star car this time. People of color have been waiting for years, and what has all this waiting gotten us?
Steve Luxenberg, what do you make of that moment?
Well, Nichols fits into a group of people who had been fighting for their rights for a long time in New Orleans. New Orleans is a very unusual place. It's the place where this case, Plessy, comes from. When the American takeover occurred in 1803, the provisional governor who arrived, William Claiborne, found himself confronted with a group of 6,000 free people of color. Mm-hmm. They weren't just free. They had a militia and they had arms. He wrote back to Madison and Jefferson in Washington a letter that took a month to arrive by boat and a month to get a reply. And he said, guys, what should I do here? We don't have anything like this in the South. And the reply from Madison was, you're on your own, buddy. We can't control things from here. Claiborne was dumbfounded. He was from Virginia. He was from a slave state. This is the history of New Orleans, this mixed race group. Many of them had been free for a long time. Plessy himself, a lot of people when I talk to them about this case assume that Plessy must have been enslaved during the Civil War. His family was enslaved during the Civil War. He was young. He was born in 1863. And that these are people who are trying to get the rights that have been denied them. Not true. You have to go back to Plessy's great-grandmother on one side of his family to find a slave. His parents were free. His grandparents were free. He is mixed race, and he was chosen to be arrested in 1896 because he was fair-skinned enough to cause confusion. And one of the things that his lawyers wanted to argue was, how the heck are you going to enforce this law requiring the separation of white and black passengers when there's a healthy population in New Orleans that is both or neither? Depends. It's New Orleans. It's not a contradiction.
There's some interesting ironies that you bring out in the book, and we only have a few minutes before the end of our first segment here. But one of them is that you know, some of these things started in the North. That is, you open the book or early pages of the book talk about Massachusetts laws separating people. One of the ironies is that some of the railroads actually didn't want those laws. It would be more expensive for them to have separate cars for blacks and whites. But also you itemize the differing realms in which laws and practices were discriminating against African Americans, and that people were hashing out what it meant, particularly after the Civil War, to allow people to be notionally free and notionally citizens, but to deny them certain elements of that citizenship. Just delineate the different realms in which some of this would play out over the next couple minutes.
Well, we immediately think when we talk about segregation, the word in the 20th century, these indelible images of separate waiting rooms, separate cars, separate hotel rooms, separate water fountains. But it's not a Southern idea. And there's an obvious reason for that once I began to dig into it. In the North, before the Civil War, there were small populations of free people of color. Massachusetts had less than 1% of its population was free people of color. In the South, first of all, they were lagging in their railroad building. And secondly, who's going to separate slave and master to put them in a separate car? You're kind of asking for trouble if you're doing that. But in the North, the question, where do I sit, is a very live one in the late 1830s when the passenger railroads come into existence. And there are three of the eight railroads, only three in Massachusetts, that choose to use separate cars. But they have as their riders abolitionists going to their night meetings. And they're thrilled because they had been on horseback going to their chapters before that, and now they're on the railroad cars. But it creates a situation. It creates a situation in which we have white and black passengers who are confronting the conductors, and the conductors are having none of it, and neither are the abolitionists. That goes on, and I can delineate it other ways, but I'm going to let you come back into the conversation.
Well, I was going to say, you know, one of the interesting things is it is confrontation. That is, it's not incidental that these things reach courts or reach state legislatures or lawmakers. It's that people are staging moments that will be spectacles, right? And that will be viewable by the public, by lawmakers, by judges, so that the injustice can be cast into sharp relief. These are not by accident, right?
No, and I don't want to be trivializing anybody here, but if you think about the resistance movements of today, There's an earlier one when David Ruggles, 1841, decides that he's going to go to court, not just protest on the train. And that's the first lawsuit that comes into being on separate but equal.
We're discussing the history of racial segregation in America. You've heard there the journalist and historian Steve Luxenberg. He's staying with us. You can join our conversation. What pressing questions do you have about race in America today? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about race in America, from segregation to the current day. You can join our conversation. What experiences have you had with racial disenfranchisement or discrimination? What have you seen in your neighborhood, your town? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking here with Steve Luxenberg. He's the author of the new book, Separate, about the history of racial segregation in America. We do have calls coursing in. I want to take a few of them. Let's go first to Detroit, Michigan. Aaron, tell us your thoughts on this and what brings you to them.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm African American. I'm 65 years old, so I've lived through the 60s, and I was old enough to remember being snatched off the sidewalk by my grandmother when a white man was approaching. So I remember those days. But what I want to say about this topic is we, as a nation, we keep acting surprised when racist things are surfacing, like this blackface and this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's very hypocritical because there's nothing has changed except for the date on the calendar. What I'd like you guys to think about, and just this thought, since I've lived long enough to see, I remember being maybe 9 or 10 years old, and my parents being outraged, and all the adults being outraged because a black man was hung in Alabama. I think it was Alabama. It might have been another state, for looking up under the dress of a white woman that was hanging on a clothesline. That was an empty dress on a clothesline, and he was accused of looking up under it, and he was hung to death, right? Shocking. In my lifetime, not ancient times, in my lifetime. And today, it's like I went to sleep, and it was against the rules to mix the race, and now every advertisement, everything you see is where they are pushing this mix on us, and I'm wondering what has changed, because a black man still can't get a cab in New York. We're still getting shot by the police like it's a game. Everything else is still outwardly racist, but that one part seems to be different. What is really going on is our hypocrisy about the whole racial divide in this country. Everything in our laws and constitutions and traditions say that blacks are to be treated less than and be kept in certain places, and whites are to be given privilege, and that is continuing. But then we want to act surprised when somebody slips up and get caught in a picture with blackface or with a Ku Klux Klan garb on, and I think it's hypocrisy.
Thank you for that, Aaron. We also have a call from Burlington, Vermont. Chris, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I grew up in the Philadelphia area, went to school in Vermont, and then immediately after taught public education down in the Mississippi Delta for 2 years. And I just want to thank you guys for having this conversation, because what your guest is saying is absolutely true. The dynamic of what happens in the North compared to what the reality is in the South and also other places, urban areas, rural areas, is hypocrisy, as the recent caller said. And the segregation that still exists in public schools down there in communities is extreme. And during the 2016 election, I was having a debate with a colleague that also grew up in the Philadelphia area that referenced, you know, the ending of separate but equal. And immediately I said, clapped back and said, sir, I'm sorry, but that is not true. I had experience with this just 5 years ago. And it's very much a reality. And to think that in Virginia, this is somehow a shock, or to think that the Democratic Party is somehow immune from nominating people that don't have this in their history is just a falsity.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, Chris. You know, Steve Luxenberg, I want to turn a little bit. The caller mentioned separate but equal, although, as you point out in your book, I think the phrase is equal but separate. But I want to turn to the actual decisions that was rendered in the case. I think it was only one dissent, but that the majority ruling goes something like this. Justice Henry Barron writes, we consider the underlying fallacy of Plessy's argument to consist in the assumption that the enforced separation of the two races stamps the colored race with a badge of inferiority. If this be so, it is not by reason of anything found in the act, but solely because the colored race, that is African Americans, chooses to put that construction upon it. Talk to me about, in some ways, the cynicism or the denial of reality or whatever it is that's embedded in that reasoning.
Well, you know, Brown grew up, Justice Brown, in an abolitionist neck of the woods in western Massachusetts. And so part of my fascination with the story is, how does he get to the point where he writes that sentence? On the other side, Justice Harlan from Kentucky, the only one whose family owned slaves in his lifetime, he comes up with the dissent. Interestingly, he embraces that very notion. He says, of course, sending people of color to a separate car, and let's face it, he said, that's what we're doing here. Of course, that is a badge of inferiority. Where does that phrase come from? It comes from the 13th Amendment, which is the one that abolishes slavery, because it includes in it that a badge of servitude is also illegal and unconstitutional. And so the lawyers for Plessy grabbed onto that phrase, and you know, they're lawyers. They want to win this case, and they are throwing the kitchen sink at the court. You don't like the 13th Amendment? We'll do the 14th Amendment. You don't like the 14th Amendment? But the 14th Amendment is the touchstone for their arguments. But the lawyer whose name was Albion Turgeon.
Remind us, though, what the 14th Amendment does.
So the 14th Amendment does several things, but the two key things, and of course, Janae Nelson from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund is going to be coming on, and she's really the expert here. I'm just the journalist. But what it does is it provides citizenship for blacks. It counters the Dred Scott decision of 1857, which said, Justice Taney said, no, blacks, free or not, cannot be citizens. And it provides equal protection under the laws for people without, you know, without distinction of color or race. And the third thing it does is to say that a state cannot abridge the rights of any citizen of the United States. And that phrase is key because the court had narrowed the interpretation to say, well, if it's not a state law, of course, Plessy was about a state law. If it's not a state law, well, we're not going to deal with what corporations can do, what companies can do, what individuals can do. This is only restricts us to the state laws that might abridge rights. And they had narrowed the interpretation over the years to the point where Plessy was a foregone conclusion when it came to the court in the press and other places.
And yet not inevitable. I do want to bring in the aforementioned Janae Nelson. She's the Associate Director of Counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, a legal organization that fights for racial justice. Janae Nelson, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You know, it's fascinating. We've been talking about Plessy versus Ferguson, its legacy, and it lives on and breathes, right, in American history. From the Oval Office in 1963, then-President John F. Kennedy addressed the nation about threats of violence over racial desegregation and references that dissent you just heard about, written by Justice John Marshall Harlan, who talked about the need for equal rights and a colorblind constitution. Here's President Kennedy.
We have a right to expect that the Negro community will be responsible, will uphold the law, but they have a right to expect that the law will be fair, that the Constitution will be colorblind, as Justice Harlan said at the turn of the century.
Now, you know, that's not just something that happened a half century ago. During confirmation hearings in recent weeks, Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut pressed federal judiciary nominee Naomi Rao on the historic decision Brown v. Board, which took place in the 50s, the case which reversed separate but equal as the idea of that being constitutional. Rao, up for a federal judgeship, would not say whether or not Brown v. Board was decided properly.
Brown is a really important precedent of the Supreme Court and one that overturned Plessy versus Ferguson, which was a real black mark in our history.
So you believe it was correctly decided?
You know, Senator, as a judicial nominee, I think it's not appropriate for me to comment on the correctness of particular precedents. I would faithfully follow them if I'm confirmed.
Janae, well, Nelson, why would not anyone from any party in this day and age, more than 60 years after Brown v. Board is decided, striking down separate but equal, why would not everyone flock to embrace that? Why is that hard?
It shouldn't be hard at all. It should be one of the easiest statements for anyone who is putting themselves forward to be a member of our esteemed judiciary, to embrace what has become a pillar in our pantheon of cases that establish the principle of equality that has really reversed the course of this country from Plessy to a path of trying to equalize opportunities for people of all races. Brown versus Board of Education was a watershed moment in our country, and it really stands, it's a court decision, but it really stands as an iconic document in writing for our country, I think as important as almost any of our foundational documents to define who we are and who this modern nation is and what our expectations are for one another and for the laws to protect everyone equally. And for Naomi Rao, as well as other nominees of this administration, Wendy Vitter and Andrew Oldham, going on this course to reject the opportunity to at least affirm that that decision was correctly decided, that legal apartheid has no place in our society, is, I think, frankly, a dog whistle to what is now an increasingly vocal and blatantly racist contingent of people in our society led by our current administration to reject these foundational principles. And I think we all should take that as a very, very dangerous signal. It is something that is a departure from earlier administrations. Every member of the current Supreme Court has affirmed the holding of Brown versus Board of Education. This is something that is beyond controversy. So we are deeply disturbed by this nominee's inability to accept that this is the rule of law in this country and must be followed and embraced by anyone who purports to be an impartial arbiter of the law.
Janae Nelson, we've heard in recent days evidence of racist acts in the more youthful adulthood of some of the top leaders in Virginia, and also, you know, other elements concerning as well, remarks by Republican Congressman Steve King, other things. People say, well, in different time we thought different ways, and yet there were voices saying things should not be we should not think differently about the races. We should not be diminishing and demeaning. In 1965, then President Lyndon Johnson delivered the commencement address at Howard University, of course, the distinctive African-American campus. And he was making a case in part for affirmative action, which people may have different feelings about in this day and age. But he's talking about American history and the centuries of repression. Here's what he had to say.
You do not take a person who for years has been hobbled by chains and liberate him, bringing up to the starting line of a race, and then say you are free to compete with all the others, and still justly believe that you have been completely fair.
Janae Nelson, what do you make of leaders now in their, call it, 50s and 60s who in their teens and 20s did things that were, you know, would strike me as being pretty overtly racist?
Well, David, I'm so glad that you played that clip, and I want to link those two things together. There's such an important perspective there that President Johnson relayed, and that is you cannot just uphold the principle of equal treatment when you are failing to recognize that there are unequal conditions that people experience based on their race, and that there is historical precedent to that, that there is government-sponsored racism and private discrimination that has all led to the unequal conditions that continue to produce inequality in our society. So it's right to point out that you cannot simply remove overt discriminatory laws and practices and expect that will equalize society when it has been unequal for so very long. And I think that when we look back at what our history has been, there really should not be any alarm. There should be concern, there should be disdain, and there should be critique and all of that when we see blackface and we see these manifestations of our racist history and present. But it's because we really have never grappled with what that has done to the psyche of all Americans. When I see those blackface photographs, I see both a disdain and hatred and mockery of African Americans. I also see, in many ways, a secret desire to inhabit blackness and the othering and the sort of pornography that, if you will, that accompanies racism. When you really don't ever reckon with the psychological motivation for race and the economic motivation for race, but it has now morphed into something that infects every aspect of how we think about one another. And until we have that reckoning, and all of these are opportunities to have that, we will never really free ourselves of that history and of its present manifestation.
You know, Steve Luxenberg, one of the reasons why it said at the top that this didn't have to be inevitable is that it seemed like a century earlier, prior to Johnson, in the aftermath of the Civil War and even leading up to it, Americans were wrestling to those very same questions. You know, is it enough to say somebody is free to say that they are equal? Is it enough to say, well, they are given accommodation to say they're being treated the same?
Well, the Republicans in Congress, and remember the Republican Party is born as an anti-slavery party in 1854, but the Republicans in Congress after the Civil War, led by Lyman Trumbull, the senator, Sumner,
sure.
They were radical Republicans, and they understood that these constitutional amendments were not enough. Just as Janae Nelson said, you can't just remove overt discrimination, and it's worse than discrimination in the 1860s. It was slavery. You can't just reverse this and say, okay, everything's fine now. So they passed, and the constitutional amendments allowed this. It said Congress can enact legislation to enforce these amendments. They enacted three civil rights laws. It wasn't easy. It didn't go easy, especially the Civil Rights Act of 1875, which was not enacted until after Sumner's death. But they enacted these pieces of legislation because they knew that they needed teeth in order to make them stick. Remember, the South, occupied by federal troops, has a huge number of Confederate soldiers and officers and leaders who would like to get back into politics. And they've been denied that by the after the Civil War.
A different form of resistance. That's Steve Luxenberg. Steve, Janae Nelson, please stick around. We want all of you to stick around. We're discussing race in America and history yesterday and today. You can join our conversation. What can we do to help resolve these racial tensions in America? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about race relations in America, spanning back centuries and as recent as this week's controversy over Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's 1984 yearbook page with a racist photo on it. You can join our conversation. What are your questions for our guests? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined today by Steve Luxenberg. He's a longtime senior editor at The Washington Post and author of the new book, Separate, about the landmark case, Plessy versus Ferguson. Also with me is Janae Nelson. She's associate director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. First, I want to turn to your calls. A bunch of people are calling in. First, I'd like to go to Fairfax Station, Virginia. Agatha, tell me what's on your mind.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Of course, I think that separate but equal is insane, but that's I don't want to hijack the conversation, but I do want to say that I think my state, Virginia, is in a bad light right now, but I do want to say that my son had a birthday party last weekend, and it kind of got out of hand a little bit because he sent it out on social media, and someone else screenshot it and so on and so forth, ended up with the police coming to the house, and they were more than gracious. I do want to say that, you know, we're African-American people and that, you know, I guess my husband's a retired colonel, and we are, I would consider, maybe middle to upper middle class. But I'm saying all that to say that I believe that had this party maybe been in another state where we're originally from, South Carolina, it might not have gone so well. So it was really good for my son to see, you know, one, the police in a great light. And the party ended up being, it was a large multicultural. I mean, you had African-Americans, white, Jewish people, Middle Easterns, Hispanics, Asians, everybody. And it was just a wonderful experience. And so although I think that I graduated high school in 82, and I can't imagine, I was just shocked when I saw blackface in 84. That just seems insane to me. But, hey, I don't know. But and I've been around the world, and I was baffled by that. But I will say that I believe that Virginia is not maybe as bad as that we've been highlighted recently. I mean, I think we've all come a long way. We certainly have a long way to go. But I definitely brought up all the points because I don't want people to, because I think economics plays a part in this as well. Because maybe had this been maybe not in an affluent neighborhood, maybe it could have gone differently. I'm not sure, but I just, you know, wanted to highlight that.
Well, thank you for that, Agatha. A perspective saying progress on racial status in America. I also want to take a call from Keith. Keith is calling from Orlando, Florida. What's been your experience, Keith?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Connecticut, and there was always this myth that segregation was in the South. Mm-hmm. But my parents immigrated to this country from the West Indies, and so their concept of racism was very different. Redlining was very much in effect. In fact, the town where we grew up was highly segregated. There were like two black families in the whole town, and the only reason we got there was because a friend of my father's, who was a Jewish realtor, he bought a house because he was pretty outraged about the injustice, and he sold it to my father. So needless to say, we had eggs thrown at the house and things scrawled on the sidewalk, people trying to move out. Eventually, people came around. But I wonder if the author of the book addressed the financial impact of segregation, because so many GIs, when they came back from World War II, benefited from the GI Bill and were able to buy homes, which we know was probably the greatest movement, upward mobility movement of wealth in this country, was through real estate, whereas black GIs were locked out of obviously better conditions. They weren't even told about the GI Bill, and that has rippled all the way down through today, where we see that the disparity between black families and white families is so great, yet so many white people will say things like, well, why don't you just forget the past and pull yourself up by your bootstraps? Well, it's been stacked against black people for a long time. Can you address this issue?
Thanks for that so much, Keith. Steve Luxenburg, obviously your book ends at the tail end of the 19th century. And that said, you know, I wonder, to the caller's point, what you saw in terms of what economic advantages were denied to African Americans as a result of the codification and the practices of racial segregation.
Well, you're right in describing the way the book ends, and I'm going to start this comment, and then I'll let Janae Nelson pick it up because she probably can speak to it better than I can. What I would say is that the caller is absolutely right, that the prohibitions, the restrictions that came along with the increasing a number of cases that came before the Supreme Court where they did not reverse Plessy led to this kind of denial of opportunity, which had been going on already in education, in housing. There are a number of good books about the redlining that began as a result of federal government policies in the 1930s. One of them is called The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. There's one by a Baltimore author, Not in My Neighborhood, by Antero Piatilla. There's also Isabel Wilkerson's Warmth of Other Suns, which is a 20th century chronicle, beautifully written, about what happened in the 20th century. It plays right in. That's why President Johnson understood that the chains had been removed, but the prohibitions had continued. And that's why when they came to that starting line he talked about, they weren't starting with equality in 1965.
But Janae, I wanted to play a clip for you. On Tuesday, Stacey Abrams offered the official Democratic response to Trump's State of the Union address. She's a voting rights activist. She narrowly lost her election for Georgia's gubernatorial race last fall amidst questions of how fairly that election was administered. And she is grounded much of her career on the idea that voting laws disproportionately disenfranchise African Americans.
Let's be clear. Voter suppression is real. From making it harder to register and stay on the rolls, to moving and closing polling places, to rejecting lawful ballots, we can no longer ignore these threats to democracy.
Janae Nelson, you're a top lawyer for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. In 2013, I think it was, Chief Justice John Roberts basically led a decision that said, look, America's had a racist past, and it was involved in disenfranchisement, but we've kind of moved past that era. Your organization, if I recall correctly, was involved in at least a response to that. How fairly did the Chief Justice assess where we are?
Oh, he was extraordinarily misguided then, and I think all of the suppressive tactics that have emerged in the wake of that decision and that were frankly ongoing at the time of that decision as well, proved how very wrong he was. That decision, Shelby County versus Holder, effectively disabled one of the most effective provisions of civil rights legislation that this country has ever known, and that was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And basically, it required areas of the country that had a sordid history of discriminatory practices in voting to seek pre-approval from the federal government before they enacted any new election practices. So it was basically a way for the federal government to ensure that minorities would not be put in a worse position by the change in a voting law, because we know from our country's past that states and local jurisdictions often manipulated voting laws as a way of keeping African Americans and other communities away from political power. So Stacey Abrams was spot on when she identified the myriad ways in which different tactics are used to keep African Americans and now Latinos and Asians and people with different language requirements from the ballot box, all in an effort to really shape the electorate in a way that yields a predetermined outcome. So we have to be extraordinarily vigilant about how we see these laws, and we have been challenging them on a number of fronts. Most recently, there's been an effort in Texas, a place where we've litigated many times on redistricting and on the very, very strict photo identification law that it imposed. But most recently, the state of Texas created a list of individuals who they identified as potential non-citizen voters, which again, it just plays into the rhetoric of anti-immigration, of racism, of discrimination, and wrongly included many individuals who are in fact citizens and eligible voters in Texas. And
right, even on its own terms, pretty hyped.
Exactly, exactly. And it's those type of tactics that mirror what the president attempted to do early on in his tenure, which was to create an election integrity commission, which we, you know, have often called a voter suppression commission, to try again to question the eligibility of voters and people who are lawfully on voter registration rolls. So we have to be attuned to these types of modern day tactics that are really just an evolution of what we saw early on when African Americans received the right to vote, like literacy tests, like poll taxes, like the many other intimidation tactics to keep us from the ballot.
I want to quickly take a couple of calls. People seem to be rappelling down the sides of buildings to call in today, and we're delighted for it. Ishmael's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Ishmael, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and I'm really appreciate Mr. Luxembourg's work and, of course, Ms. Nelson's work. But I just want to be get a couple of points. I'm a researcher. I graduated from the University of Virginia with my doctorate, and I was a former assistant dean there. But there's certain things that I think on the broader subject coming out of Plessy that we don't talk about and may be important. There's a book called The Black Lawyers. And in that book, when it is a discussion of Brown, coming up to Brown, there was a push by the president in 1950s to get a unanimous decision in Brown through the Warren Court. They realized that the same kind of decision that came down in Plessy couldn't go forward for Brown if it was going to make things real. One reason that is stated, I'll just give this reason, was that many of the black intellectuals were in fact looking to Europe and saying, look, if something doesn't happen here, we're headed out. And so were a whole lot of other folks. So that's one point. The second point is that in my research, and I spent a good deal of time looking at the term desegregation, coming up in the 60s, I'm 69 years old, coming up in the 50s, 60s, on, we never discussed desegregation. The discussion was about integration. And I have interviews. So I went to interview Julian Bond, Zelma Henderson from the Brown, Mrs. Henderson, other folk, and just asked about why did we shift to that term. And all of them agreed, including Sheryl Brown Henderson, that reflected a turn back to the public policy dialogues that were shaped by the people who were still in power, not by the people who were thought to become enfranchised. So integration kind of went its way. More research should be done on that.
Let's bounce that off our guest for a moment. I think you raised such an interesting point, that distinction. I want to thank you, Ishmael, for that. But that distinction between desegregation and integration. Janae Nelson, you know, the NAACP has been at the Legal Defense Fund, has been at the forefront of a lot of this over the decades. Talk to me about that distinction and what it's meant for where we are right now.
Absolutely. Our founder, Thurgood Marshall, litigated the Brown versus Board of Education case, which, as I said, was so transformative for this country, which was, you know, an effort that consolidated five cases to end legal apartheid in America. And your caller, Ishmael, is correct that there is a distinction between desegregation and integration. So desegregation lifts the formal barriers to the separation of races. Integration is a very different effort, which really requires, I think, a much more significant evolution in the mindset of our country to eliminate the idea that races should be separated on any level, and allows us to live together and work together and socialize together in a way that is free from any of the historical restrictions that have bound us. And that is an enterprise that is an extraordinarily difficult one, one that we promote and one that we endorse, but it's very different from the enterprise of ending formal segregation. And, you know, as I said earlier, listing of laws and changing specific practices does not then all of a sudden lead to the automatic equalization of everyone in this country when we have such a sordid past. And I will say something about, you know, this particular moment that we're in. You know, we are now 400 years out from what many believe was the first arrival of enslaved Africans on this continent. And it's important that we recognize how far we've come, but really what is left in this
How far we've come and how far we have to go in an eternal dilemma, our original sin, race relations. You've just been hearing Janae Nelson, Associate Director, Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Janae, thanks for being on our show. Steve Luxenberg, longtime senior editor at the Washington Post. His new book is Separate, The Story of Plessy versus Ferguson. Thanks to you, Steve Luxenberg. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik. We're out. This is On Point.